Hi and welcome to the Prodcast, your fix for everything innovative in advertising and production. I'm Pat Murphy and I've been working in this industry for more than 35 years now. I've seen a lot of changes, but trust me, there's plenty more around the corner. Each week on the podcast, you'll hear from one of the movers and shakers shaping the world of advertising and production for the future. And we'll dive into some of the key challenges facing our sector today and how we're best placed to overcome them. Today, we're speaking to someone who sits right at the heart of modern culture, influence and creativity, Mary Beckhite, Group CEO of YMU, one of the world's most powerful talent management companies representing global names across entertainment, music, sport and business. Mary has led YMU through a major transformation, turning it into a progressive, social-first, globally integrated talent powerhouse. She's a champion of diversity, a modernizer of the talent industry, and a leader who believes deeply in clarity, courage and authenticity. Whether you know it or not, you've almost certainly felt the impact of the talent she and her teams help shape. Mary, welcome to my humble podcast.
Thank you so much. What an intro.
Now, I saw you must have been about a year ago in Cannes, and you were telling me about the transformation you're going through at YMU. Is that now finished? Still work to do?
It's always ongoing. We love the opportunities that come with the changes in the industry. And I think, you know, we've seen so much, haven't we, over the last 10, but in particular, I'd say the last 5 years. And it's been a really interesting ride for us because so much of our past and our heritage was based on linear TV in the UK. And I'm proud to say we still retain so much of that business. It's done an incredibly important part of the ecosystem. But of course, it's contracted over the last few years. And what we've done is to respond to that and to see that as a huge opportunity and not necessarily just a challenge, because of course it's challenging as well, and embrace, you know, some of the social media opportunities, both from now representing social first talent, but also helping our more quote traditional talent embrace social. And we've done that in parallel, and we've done that, I would say, relatively successfully. So enjoying to continue the transformation. I never think that work is done, actually.
Now, I see you everywhere on LinkedIn. Right. Long. Every time I put my LinkedIn on, there you are.
Apologies.
You're somewhere, or you're on a panel somewhere. That must mean you have the most incredible operational team to back you up in the office.
Yeah. The entire philosophy of YMU is about the power of the collective. No one person makes YMU work. We have got a phenomenal team, and I can say that hand on heart. Not just people who are brilliant at their job and phenomenal operators, and of course you need those, but people that genuinely align with the values of the group, which are around being client first, around collaboration, around, you know, courage, curiosity, being egoless. And I feel unbelievably privileged to work with the people that I do. We have brilliant managing directors, we have brilliant ops people, brilliant finance people, and those sort of hundreds of people come together as a collective in order to get the right outputs for our client. But yeah, I couldn't do what I do on a day-to-day basis without the team behind me.
So let's go back to the beginning. You actually wanted to be a music journalist.
I did. I obviously went left at the lights somewhere. I don't know what happened, Pat. But I loved music growing up. I still love music now. I was fascinated by it. And I thought the right way, or the closest way for me to get close to musicians and bands and that energy was journalism. And actually, as I started on that journey, it was very, very light touch. I soon realized that actually what I wanted was to be in the room where talent made decisions and help influence those decisions. So the music journalism was kind of a first step in trying to understand why I was so attracted to creative people and the creative industries. And then it gave me that kind of that glimpse into, okay, I actually want to be in the room with these people when they're making their product, when they're making decisions that matter. And so that's kind of how it evolved. But yes, it was initially what I wanted to do.
So did you ever become a music journalist in the end or not?
No, I did a series of internships for the NME and Melody Maker and Select and a whole bunch of magazine and papers, some of which no longer
exist,
sadly.
Only some of us remember those, by the way.
I know, I'm giving away my age here, but they were huge at the time. So I did that for a little bit whilst I was also studying, but no, I never fully transitioned into that.
So how did you go from that ambition then to running one of the most successful talent management companies?
Gosh, it's been a long walk. It's been a very, very long walk. And it was never my ambition to be the CEO of a talent management company. That was never some sort of North Star in my head. I always took the next interesting opportunity. I always concentrated on doing a brilliant job of whatever I was doing at the time. And I always say this internally, whatever small thing you do, that's the way you do everything, you know? I started at a much smaller agency called Limelight. Having left university, I saw a tiny advert that said agent seeks assistant on the University of London website. I thought, like, I think I know what that is, but I don't really. Got the job, and I thought, I'll do this for 6 months until I figure out what I'm doing. And I ended up staying for 7 years. And it was a great education there because it was small. You had to do everything. You had to do the brand deal, the live deal, the TV deal, the book deal, the everything deal. And I did that for 7 years, and I sort of reached a ceiling there, and I'd had a great run. But I thought, God, I better do something. What am I going to do with my life? I've got to, you know, turn 30. And it felt like a moment to start to take stock. And Broadcast, which is obviously a TV trade magazine, ran a sort of list of 30 under 30. And I thought, oh, God, this is my last chance saloon. I'm 30. I better have a go. So I said to my boss, look, I think it would be really good for the agency and me to do it. And it was the first year they allowed managers and agents into that list. And I got in. And it was great because it kind of came out in August. I was in the office working late, as I often did, and I got a call from CAA. And they said, hey, we saw your picture in Biog. Kind of feels like we do the same sort of thing. And I was like, yeah, sure, blagging it. And they were going to Cannes, but they were going to stop via London. And they said, oh, let's have this meeting. So I had the meeting. It was all very exciting. I was like, oh, this is great. This is exactly what I wanted to happen. You know, like, gosh, what a gift. It was the right time, the right agency, but the job they were offering me was not right. I then was sort of talking about this, and somebody I knew said, oh, you should go and speak to an agent at James Grant. They're looking for somebody. And so the rest is history. I then got the gig at James Grant, which then became YMU, as a director in their entertainment division. And I just grew from there within the agency. But it took a decade to get to the CEO position. But I've loved every step of the way. And I always encourage people to not so always worry on the end goal, and I've got to get this particular position, but actually really enjoy what you're doing in the moment, be phenomenal at it, add more than is expected, and the next opportunity will automatically unlock. Mm. And I've always done that, and it's paid dividends in my career. It really has.
Yeah, my dad actually said that. He said, look, if you're going to do something, just make sure you do it brilliantly. Be the best
the way
at
you
it,
do
right?
One thing is the way you do everything. I truly believe it. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, what I called you a talent management company, because you're not really like a traditional talent agency, are you? You kind of look after the whole holistic side of your talent.
That's right. So we very much sort of identify as managers versus agents. So I know there isn't really much of a differentiator in the UK, but from our perspective, we see ourselves as long-term creative and strategic partners to our clients. And in order for us to get to the right outcomes for our clients, you know, we represent elite clients. We represent people that are at the top of their game, have had longevity over decades. In order for us to be able to give them the right advice, we believe that they need subject matter experts in lots of different areas. So, of course, they have a relationship lead, you know, the kind of the director of the account. But that director can then plug into this array of expertise across the building, whether that's brand, literary, live, social, TV, podcast, you know, commercial, whatever it might be. There's a person or many teams in our building that can give them really cogent, well thought through advice that is driven from market intelligence versus, I don't know, just personal instinct. There is still a place for personal instinct. We really believe that. But that instinct needs to be married with data, market intelligence, and it needs to come from the collective intellect and insight, not one person. And that's very much our philosophy here.
I guess the talent that you do look after feel very comforted in the fact that you are looking after the whole kind of area. It's not just about the money and the deals. It's about everything else as well.
Absolutely.
When you took on the role in 2021, though, what did you think was the first thing that you needed to evolve in the business?
It was definitely accepting this opportunity around social media. I think that was the thing that I was absolutely determined that we needed to run at. So we had all of this brilliant, established, phenomenal talent. We still have them. Anton Deck, Simon Cowell, Graham Norton, you name it. We've still got them. But they weren't necessarily making the most of the opportunity on social platforms. And in addition to that, I could also see that there were lots of people making extremely good businesses out of being social first talent. So first thing we did was to invest in the infrastructure, the knowledge and the skills within the business in order to advise our clients in that space. How are you going to actually translate this brilliant brand into a two-way conversation across various social media platforms? How do you do that consistently in that always-on era when you're used to a very traditional one-way broadcast, high production values, waiting for a commissioner to say yes? This is an exciting opportunity to say, you're not reliant on four gatekeepers at BBC or Sky or whoever. You can immediately come up with an idea, create it. You don't need a shit ton of cash to do it. And you've got an audience giving you real life data. You know, we can pivot, we can evolve, we can iterate. Super exciting. So we did that. Then in addition to that, we also, there was a management company called Gleam Futures, which at that point was the preeminent social first management, the sort of James Grant of the social world. And we had looked at them and admired what they had achieved over the last sort of 10 years in the creator economy. And so we kind of made a move on them, brought the leader over, brought the entire team over and all of their clients. And with those clients came, you know, some really, really big names. But along with those big, big clients, it also gave us huge amounts of insight, knowledge and skill in the creator economy. And so the combination that we were able to put together in our entertainment division of these mega, mega, mega established names with these brilliant social first creators, blending the skill base and the opportunities around both types of talent has been phenomenally successful for YMU.
Mm. You talk about clarity, courage, and curiosity as part of your leadership principles. First of all, where did those come from and how did they guide all the decision-making that you do?
Yeah, I think courage, I honestly think, is a fundamental of leadership. So often people struggle with saying the difficult thing, having the difficult conversation and doing the right thing, even when it's hard, when it's not the most expedient thing, when it's not the most popular thing, when lots of people are telling you to do this and that, actually having the courage to listen to your inner voice and align with your values versus taking the quick check or doing the popular thing, I think is a fundamental of leadership and I really believe in it. That married with clarity, if people don't understand what you want from them, where the company is going, what the vision is, and believe that you are a person that says what you mean, and I've always been that to a fault sometimes in terms of directness. You know, I say what I mean, I don't say things that I don't mean. I think people respond to that and you can go on a journey and build trust and relationships with people. Those are incredibly important to me. And curiosity is absolutely critical in what we do. If you don't have intellectual curiosity, if you're not wondering what's going on, what's going to happen next, and how can we be part of that, and what's going on over there, and who's that, and curious about people, then I don't know how you succeed in any business, let alone our business.
And you've taken concrete action as well on that gender pay gap at YMU.
Yeah.
What shifts do you think other companies could take if they genuinely want to create fair and equitable workplaces?
I think so much of it starts with being honest. So being honest about the fact that there is a gap, that's uncomfortable, how we got to a place where the gap is as large as it is in some instances, and simply actually just almost saying, look, having an amnesty and saying, look, we've got ourselves in a position where we've got a large gap. We've tried to hide that or we haven't necessarily been as honest about that. We are now presenting this to you internally and the broader world, and we're going to make determined steps to close it. But so often I feel a lot of companies feel uncomfortable just even being honest about what's going on in the business to themselves and to the team and to the outside world. So I think that's a fundamental way of starting to tackle it. The second piece is to then actually take some proactive steps to close it. We all know what that looks like, right? That's promoting women into positions of power where they're going to get access to bigger salaries. It's making sure that you've got a pipeline of women coming through that can, you know, really build meaningful careers and can be compensated accordingly. But everything starts with the truth.
And that's made you an inspiration to other
women coming
into the industry. There's no question about that. And you've said that women need to, quote, stand in their power in the talent world, you know, where confidence, visibility and narrative matter. What does that look like for female leaders and female talent in general today?
I don't think there's one massive moment where they declare to the world, I'm standing my power. I think it's small incremental moves that compound over time. So I think it's about showing up to a meeting where you might not want to say anything, but kind of making sure that you do get your voice heard, even if it's a small thing, but you have articulated and contributed to a conversation and not just sat back. It's maybe going for that promotion before you necessarily feel right for it. And I work with men and women, and my experience has been that men often put themselves forward for roles before they necessarily feel that they're ready. That's whereas so women wait sort of 5-10 years, prove that they've checked every single conceivable box, and then say, would you consider me? It's like, of course.
Yeah, yeah. I'm guilty. I'm very guilty of that. You know, when I started in the industry, I went to work for a post house called Molinaire, which is my first ever job. And it was as a runner, but I promoted myself into 3 different roles in 12 months.
Yeah.
And I literally called myself a different title every 3 months.
Yeah, fine.
It was like, it works, behave, right? Behave as if, I guess.
Absolutely. You know? And I think women need to do the same thing. Yeah. They're often, you know, the way that women are brought up is to be, you know, be a good girl and sit there quietly and, you know, do all the right things. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, having some decorum and not necessarily trying to aggressively control every room. But I do think that there is an opportunity for women to be more proactive and tougher in terms of how they approach their career. And I think visibility is a part of that. I think that's a line we're all straddling with, right? You know, being a visible leader and making sure that you're visible because that creates opportunity, but not substituting that with substance at the same time. But I think putting yourself out there, having a voice, pushing yourself outside of your comfort zone, and creating opportunities for yourself, because nobody is going to knock on the door, open it and say, would you like an opportunity? You are going to have to hustle and create them for yourself. My experience has been that men are often quite good at that.
Yeah.
And I think women have some way to go sometimes.
What leadership lessons has parenting given you that business couldn't?
Patience. It is extraordinary how it tests your patience. And empathy. Slowing down. Sometimes, you know, I'm a very fast-paced person. I like, you know, speed is incredibly important to me, and I think it's important in business. But it's important to make sure that you're taking people with you. And I think empathy is a big, big part of business. I think patience is a big part of business. And I think active listening is a big part of business. Historically, I think prior to being a mum, I probably would have been like, yeah, cool, let's go. Just get to the destination, go. And now actually I think, no, this person is actually trying to communicate something to me. And it might take me a little longer than I want in the meeting in order to get to that nugget, but I'm going to give them the space and the time to tell me what they need to tell me. And I think being a mum has made me slow down in order to listen actively to people, which in turn has made me more empathetic as a leader.
Authenticity for me in our business is really important, and I think it is in yours as well. How do you maintain that authenticity in a world driven by data and attention?
I think it's about genuinely encouraging our talent, our team, to be themselves. We don't want perfect AI slop. Like, we all know what ChatGPT can do. We understand that. The knowledge piece is done, right? Anybody now with access to the internet can get infinite amounts of knowledge, where historically you had to go to an expert. That's gone, right? Anyone in the, you know, click of their fingers can get access to phenomenal amounts of knowledge. What people need now is context and judgment. And that is a human trait. People want to see your analysis, your insight, your personal take on whatever the situation is. And so I think actually, in an age of AI, where everything's becoming so easily imitated and quotable, what we're all yearning for is this human, bespoke, crafted feel to things. That sort of almost messy middle piece. That is what people are responding to, not this curated perfection. It's exhausting, it's boring, it doesn't make you feel anything. And actually, what makes you feel something is the human judgment, creativity, passion. I don't believe AI can replace that. I think it can make us quicker and more expedient at things. But I feel that authenticity is the thing that people connect with. And for our talent, so much of their brand and business is based on being able to build a connection.
Oh, I completely agree. So you brought up AI, so I'm going to carry on with AI, if that's okay. I mean, how is that impacting your world? And would you ever think about looking after an influencer that might be AI created?
Yeah. It's interesting because I think AI is genuinely a challenge and opportunity for our business and our clients. I think AI is brilliant in terms of expediting a lot of the mediocre stuff that needs to happen, right? So it's great with admin and it's great with doing editing and that sort of thing. It's been amazing. There's no question to that. But we've also had trouble with, you know, deep fakes and synthetic media with our clients as well, which is deeply frustrating. And of course, culture and technology move faster than regulation. So no one quite knows how to manage this really at the platforms or anywhere else. So I think that's an ongoing industry struggle. What I would say about whether we would represent an AI influencer, yes, possibly. I would never say never. As long as that was clear, we were crystal clear that this was what was happening and we weren't pretending that this was a real person. But is there a world where 5-10 years down the line I could see that? Yeah. Truth, yeah, I can. I think it is entirely possible that we would be representing AI individuals. I don't see it immediately, but I wouldn't close it off either.
No, of course. You've set up a division for women's football.
We have.
Tell me something a little bit about that. Explain more about what that's all about.
We see a massive opportunity in women's football. It's one of the fastest growing sports in the world. We're lucky to have a established transatlantic men's football division. We've had that for about 20 years. But actually, we're seeing what's happening around culture, brands, commercial, converging around the women's space. And we're seeing, you know, audiences really turn in to what's going on in the women's football space. I'm not sure that enough investment has gone in to what is an incredibly exciting sport. We see the opportunity. We see the opportunity to help these phenomenal athletes tell their stories more effectively, to be commercialized more effectively and build careers with real longevity, but to do that in a way that feels different from the men's side. So not a copy paste of what we've done in men's football to women's football, but saying, look, if we've got the opportunity to build this thing from the ground up, what do these girls and women need in order to succeed? And that's a different approach to healthcare. That's a different approach to their mental attitudes. That's understanding that they're going to go through different biological and physical things throughout the course of their career and a different way that they might want to tell their stories. So we are, fingers crossed, on the cusp of announcing a mega name in that space, as well as a new managing director and some interesting European businesses as well. So we've gone hell for leather in it because we really think that the opportunity over the next 5-10 years to not just do some interesting commercial and storytelling work around women's football, but actually to change culture and to push culture forward is really exciting. Our mission is to, you know, unlock the power of the elite individual to push culture forward. And for us, that's incredibly exciting. And as a female-led business, this feels like the right thing to be doing on a number of levels.
Do you think that will expand into other kind of women's sports as well?
Potentially. I'd like to start with women's football, do a really good job of that,
yeah,
and then potentially expand into other areas as well.
What is YMU Ventures?
So it's a new ventures fund that we've created to enable our talent to take their ideas and to accelerate the growth of those ideas. So we have a long history of giving sort of intellectual and human capital to our clients' ideas, and of course, money as well. But we'd like to have a large pot where we say, okay, we've got phenomenal clients, we've got brilliant ideas, they've got large audiences. How do we help them take the ideas out of their head and commercialize them to build brands that have real longevity? And the talent game now is no longer just about taking a commission check. That's the bread and butter. That's the sort of expectation. What people want, what our clients want, is to be able to take all of this energy, this momentum, this attention that they're building and create meaningful brands. And those brands could take a variety of forms. It might be a live event. It might be an album. It might be a product. Our job is to help them make the smartest commercial decisions in order to fulfill that and to create something with real meaning and value in the long term. So ventures exists in order to achieve that for our clients.
That's your fun pot to experiment
with,
I guess.
It is our fun pot. It is exactly that.
And you know what? That's what makes it really interesting, I guess, for the talent to be with you, because you need to have that kind of ability to be creative in all sorts of different areas. So
you do. Yeah. And also to give them, you know, security and longevity. Our clients come to us for relevance, you know, to be a commercial in the here and now, but also for longevity, knowing that we've got their long-term creative and commercial interests at heart, which we absolutely do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you look after some of the biggest names in the business around the world. Mentioning no names.
Yeah, okay.
What's been the most gloriously ridiculous thing a talent has requested, and how did you deal with it?
God, that's a good question. I mean, we've had some pretty odd riders.
And I've experienced a lot of them on the other side. So
stuff where you're like, okay, but you're literally on stage for 20 minutes and you have requested what is genuinely, it's got to be about £10,000 worth of champagne of the highest order, notwithstanding a variety of other things that go with. So some of those, you know, you kind of sit there going, is this, do we really think this is a reasonable request, truly? For a 30-minute stage appearance, you know, that you're down the road from. I've had talent call me in the middle of the night around font size on an advert. I've had a variety of things happen over the years. But what I will say is that one of our philosophies, one of our sort of values is around only taking on talent that you feel that you would want to go to lunch with.
Right.
And I'm not just saying this, but we are blessed with some extraordinary human beings, not least, you know, we recognise that they're brilliant at their job and they're phenomenal. They've got millions of followers. That's all brilliant. But actually, the people that they are underneath, we are unbelievably lucky as an agency to work with the people we do. Yeah. They're brilliant.
I was going to ask you, actually, you know, do you ever turn people down, and how do you choose which talent to take on?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got to make sure you like working with people.
Absolutely. Yes, we do turn people down a lot. As I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, just the volume of resource we put around individuals, it has to make sense. We have to passionately believe in that individual in order to make that time and human capital investment in them. We try to be as elite as possible in terms of the individual that we work with. So there is a set of criteria that we apply when we're thinking about signing new clients, and that is, do we genuinely believe that this person is A, elite, or has the potential to be elite? Do we see that the market is responding to them and wants to engage and work with them? Do they have a good reputation? Are we finding that audiences are gravitating to them in a meaningful way, not just reach for reach sake, but deep engagement, community building? Are they doing something interesting in the culture? Are they actually affecting change in some way? These are all the things that we think about in the round when we look at new clients, and yeah, we are selective about who we bring on as a result of that.
Now, one of the nicest surprises, and I think I mentioned it to you last year, was the interview that Simon Cowell did with Stephen Bartlett, Diary of a CEO. And in that space of about an hour or so, I thought, I really like this guy. And
yeah,
it completely changed my view of Simon. Was that the strategy that you had?
Yeah, exactly that. I think people see Simon as the phenomenal media creative entrepreneur that he is. There are very few people that you could cite out of the UK that have had the effect globally on the media landscape that Simon has had. So I think he's well established and got that respect, but very few people, I think, understand him as an individual. And we wanted to bring that part of him more to the fore, which is, yes, you know, this kind of mega entrepreneur, but also this is a guy that's gone through so much in his life, whether that's grief or bankruptcy or, you know, losing things and starting things and actually trying to make him a more rounded character, more understood as a human, not just as a kind of almost caricature or this famous guy over here. And the outpouring of emotion and connection that followed that interview, to your point, I think made that piece of positioning very effective from our perspective.
That was great.
Thank you.
Now, you've got talent that have been successful for decades.
Yes.
The likes of Anton Deck and Graham Norton, people like that. But how do you manage to keep them relevant for decades? I mean, that must be so hard. What's the recipe for that?
I think a lot of it comes from them. So, you know, I'd love to say it's all us. It's working in combination with people that are genuinely brilliant. They intuitively understand where the next trend is coming. They understand that they need to embrace the new and not fight it. And so you look at people like Anton Deck, who could very happily sit on ITV, got I'm a Celebrity, Britain's Got Talent, these big behemoths, that kept them at the top of their game. But they don't just settle for that. They think, okay, well, what's next? And so they've got this, you know, new podcast, Hanging Out with Anton Deck. They've got their social channel, Belterbox, on YouTube. They spend time on their Instagram, etc. They're always thinking about the next thing, and the thing, and they're creative fundamentally at their heart. So they're able to take that, create brilliant ideas, produce them, and then distribute them in different ways for different channels. And I think they're phenomenal. Like a Davina McCall, for example. You know, she comes from a place of authenticity, and I think audiences understand that. So when she was going through the menopause, she was like, this is happening to me. I cannot get access to resource or information that is useful. I'm going to change the game here. And she went on a mission. You know, she did some documentaries for Channel 4. She then wrote a book called Menopausing, which went, you know, absolutely huge bestseller, won Book of the Year at the Nibbies. But she's actually had an impact on the culture. She's changed the way millions of midlife women in the UK approach their health now. It's that authenticity, it's that creativity, and it's an ability to take what's within them and apply it to the moment. Our job is to help them tell that story as effectively as possible.
Let's talk about brand and talent partnerships, because I'm guessing you're really selective about what brands you place with your talent. How do you go through that process? How do you choose whether it's the right job for one of your talent?
First, I think it's a values overlap with a brand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's not just a case of, is the money right? And are they saying that we're going to reach X number of people? It's actually like, okay, so this is the brand. This is what they stand for. This is what they're trying to achieve. Does this truly align and overlap with the values and vision of this individual? The answer to that is yes. And actually, it's quite difficult for that answer to be a yes. Then let's do it. And our philosophy with brands is, look, sometimes there is a time and a place to have a short turnaround partnership. We get that. And we don't object to that. But 9 times out of 10, what we're trying to achieve with a brand is to say, look, you will get a much fuller, much more engaged and successful outcome if you actually go on a meaningful journey with this talent. So instead of it just being a one, done, off we go, why don't we actually create a roadmap of something that is real and authentic and meaningful and takes the audience with us on this journey? And those are the brands that we like to work with and tend to see the most success with.
And what are some examples of great collaborations for you?
So I would say things like Anton Deck and Santander as an example. You know, that one, you know, media awards, it was in the public consciousness, it tapped into Anton Deck's creativity, it was funny, but it landed the message. You know, it was one of those ads where you weren't quite sure who actually came up with the concept. Was it Anton Deck? Was it the brand? It sort of perfectly fused into something that was effective for the brand, was great for Anton Deck, won awards and connected with audiences and lasted for many, many years, right? It continues to last as an example. It's those sorts of deals where you go, yeah, this is it. This is the one that's humming.
It's a win-win for both sides, isn't it?
Exactly. And that's what you want. Yeah. That's what you want.
Great. Do you think that talent managers, and I'm sure you've got some brilliant ones, and I know you've got some brilliant ones in your business. Do you think that they're good at their job because they love people, or because they can read people?
It's a good question. I think it's a mixture of the two things. I think you shouldn't be in talent management where you have a deeply personal relationship with your clients if you don't like people. And so much of it is chemistry led. So I think being able to read your client and understand them so well that you can get to a point where you're almost anticipating their needs, or you might have a read on how they think about something even before you've put it to them. I think that is a skill, and I think that is difficult to replicate and scale. But I think a lot of our talent managers have a lot of emotional intelligence and the bandwidth to do that. And I think that's a really fundamental part of our job. We are working with human beings. They're not products, they're humans. And those human relationships are critical to the success of us being able to look after our clients effectively.
In my job over the years, I've had bouts of imposter syndrome, right? Mm-hmm. I sometimes kind of go, how on earth did I get here?
Yeah.
Have you ever felt that way?
Yeah, of course. I think anyone that's had any modicum of success will go, oh my God, me, really? But I think as you kind of go through the path of life and you kind of achieve more and, you know, you kind of get the data that actually, yeah, I've done these things and these are all things that I can point to that are credible and real and exciting. I feel that less and less through my career these days. Not to say that, you know, I don't get intimidated or whatever, all of the stuff that we all feel. But yeah, I would say I feel that less now than I did when I first started.
Who's the real Mary, though? You know, when no one needs anything from you.
Yes, that's
who
rare.
Who is the real Mary?
I don't know. I'm just a person that, you know, I've got a brilliant family. I've got all of those sorts of things. But I'm a person that if I'm left to my own devices and I have a day to myself and no responsibilities, I'll go to a gallery, I'll read a book, I will, you know, go and watch a film. I'm somebody that loves culture. I'm somebody that loves storytelling. I'm fascinated by other people. And I'm a bit of an introvert, actually. I'm not out, you know, partying all the time or anything like that. I like being with a small group of people pursuing my passion, which is around culture, art, music, fashion, those sorts of things. Yeah. So if I got a day to myself, I'm doing something in one of those spaces.
Now we're going into a new kind of era, the whole AI era. And, you know, we've got a lot of kids that are coming out of college. You know, you've got kids too, as I have. You know, what are you advising kids to learn or to study when they leave college? You know, what is the whole job situation? What are the skills that the kids are going to need in this new era of AI?
I think it's the human skills, right? I think it's the emotional intelligence. I think it's the ability to collaborate and work in teams. I think it's about storytelling. I think so much of the future is going to be handed to the individuals, no matter what the context or distribution platform, that are able to take the complexities of modern life and modern business and create stories that cut through and reach people in whatever way. And there's such a race for attention. There's so many messages that we're bombarded with. I think if you are a person entering the workforce that has an ability to break down complexity, to take that and turn it into storytelling that takes people with you, whether that's a small group of people or an enormous group of people, that's enormously valuable. I think that as the knowledge piece becomes ubiquitous and everyone has access to that, your ability to navigate humans and bring them together in order to execute is, at the end of the day, AI can't actually do the thing. How you use and harness some of that emotional intelligence in order to get to the outcomes that you individually or a business want is incredibly important. Curiosity, not just going, okay, I'll whack it in ChatGPT and see what happens, but actually taking the time to really go deep into areas of passion. And authenticity, right? Nobody wants this perfect curated influencer turning up at the doorstep. We want you to be you and to contribute as yourself. And it's that diversity that makes a business richer. So that's what I would encourage anyone to focus on.
I think it is. You're right. It's the human skills, particularly as, you know, more and more kids, they're getting stuck in their, you know, phones and iPads, and they're losing the ability to communicate.
Completely agree.
And I think that the human skills, like selling and influencing and negotiating and all of these things, are going to become more important. No one's going to buy from a robot.
Exactly.
They're going to buy from a human being.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that's really critical. So that's the stuff I'm teaching my kids.
Absolutely agree. It's needed and probably neglected, I would say, at this stage.
Now, I could talk for you for hours, but I can't.
The same.
So
okay.
I'm going to have to finish this. So, but we got one more question, of course. Okay. It's always the question we ask at the end. Mary, what's your favorite ad of all time?
The one that comes to mind is, I don't know if you remember it, but it was Sophie Dahl for the opium advert for Yves Saint Laurent. And she's completely naked. She's this alabaster white skin, fiery red hair on this sort of black background. And it was genuinely arresting at the time because, you know, I was relatively young. And it was like, my God, there was this unbelievably striking visual. But once you kind of honed in, it was this woman in a moment of pleasure, and it was sexual and explicit and quite exciting and unapologetic. And that, I felt, was a woman standing in her power. This was not, you know, a little shrinking violet doing her usual smelling a rose for a perfume advert. This was a woman who was embodying freedom and sexuality, ambition, this extraordinary aesthetic, and all of that coming together. I found unbelievably compelling and arresting, and I always remember that advert.
Mary, it's been such a delight to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you, Pat. Yeah, and, I really appreciate the time.
I guess I'll see you in a couple of weeks in Cannes.
You will. I look forward to it.
Today, we've been talking to Mary Beckheit, a leader redefining what talent, culture, and creativity looks like in the modern world. Her work is a reminder that influence isn't just about reach, it's about authenticity, narrative, and purpose. If you have any comments, questions, or feedback, please email us at podcast@murphycobb.com. I'm Pat Murphy, CEO of MCA. Do come and connect with us on LinkedIn or Instagram. All the links are in the show notes there. And please like the podcast at your favorite platform. Thanks again to Mary, my team at MCA, and to my production partners at What Goes On Media. Thanks for listening. See you next time.